because the nature of the women is somehow changed in the modern world society. We know that with the presence of the women in the society and working out, some of their behaviors have become manly and robust, okay?
Exactly.
So the serious behavior when unfortunately got into the house can make, we can say, the men also the victims of domestic violence. But all in all, the foundation of the family is very much respected by the religion of Islam. We can say, and I think Prophet Muhammad, the Holy Quran, and the Hadith of the Ahlul Bayt has proved this point that the family foundation is sacred, and is holy, and this holiness have to be kept alive.
Exactly. Family, extremely important in Islam.
Yes.
Wife and husband, family issues.
Yes.
It is very important. For example, قُوْ أَنفُسَكُمْ وَأَهْلِيكُمْ نَارًا, to protect yourself and your family members from the hellfire, which put a lot of responsibility on the husband's shoulder.
Yes.
Okay. As a manager of the house, you have to be to manage your wives, to manage the not only the financial issues, rather the spiritual issues within your family members.
That's all right. You know, some people might not know that the religion of Islam has practical guidelines how to behave your family members and children. Even in very, we can say, private matters, like, for example, sexual intercourse or sexual, we can say, behaviors inside the house, the religion of Islam has practical guidelines. So, and this is what the modern psychology also tries to answer in today's world. But some people might not know that the religion of Islam has tackled these issues more than 14 centuries ago, and this is really fascinating.
Exactly. Before the birth of children, we
yes.
have in the time of the pregnancy,
very good.
They have a lot of recommendation.
Yes.
I do not want to mention that with regard to the nourishment of the wife, with regard what to eat, what to drink, about many supplication.
You know that many children in the Western world are, we can say, aborted during pregnancy of the women because of the domestic violence.
Exactly.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I think the emphasis on maintenance of family is too much in Islamic religion.
Yes.
And part of the reason actually comes to the children.
Yes.
Because if we want to support the children, mm-hmm. to have the successful children in the future, you have to maintain this family. So we do not have single parenting or,
yes.
for example, divorce or this, family trauma. Rather, Islam emphasizes on having and maintenance of the family structure and to have the lovely, and very calm atmosphere providing for the children in order to have the brilliant children in future.
That's all right. Also, I think taking counsels from spiritual and religious people
exactly,
and counselors
yes.
can be very much helpful.
Exactly.
Because
much.
The people are not complete. They are in need of a trainer, a spiritual trainer, akhlaq teacher, okay? Especially in the Muslim lands. They can refer to them and ask them for practical guidelines.
Islamic psychology is kind of, mm-hmm. is actually one of the new branches that many people are working on.
Yes.
And we have a lot of Islamic counselors, even in the, in Islamic Republic of Iran and maybe in other countries, they provide you with the Islamic consultation with regard to the education of bringing of children. So it is very necessary if you want to learn the etiquette and some of the skills of how to behave with your family members, how to tackle these kind of problems, to have this kind of consultation with the Islamic counselors.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Nurmanpour, for a nice elaboration regarding the concept of domestic violence and how the religion of Islam can help us in order to prevent and stop domestic violence, especially victimizing of the women inside the family. It was very kind of you, Sheikh.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In this week's show, we'll be examining the record of Zionist aggression against black and African American movements from the 1950s to the present day. I'll be talking to experts on this issue after this special report by Latifa Abu-Chakra on the shameful history of the Zionist movement's attacks on black leaders and movements.
The active use of the tropes about black anti-Semitism by Zionist groups in relation to recent controversies has a history. We trace the evolution of the anti-Arab and specifically anti-black racism of the Zionist movement back to the 1960s and beyond. Attacks on prominent black celebrities and activists for their anti-Semitism are not new. They have a history. In fact, there have been attacks led by Zionist groups against practically all black leaders or prominent figures of note, from Marcus Garvey in the 1930s to today. His alleged antipathy to Jews was denounced, as were a whole host of black leaders inspired by Garvey through to the 1960s. One organization key to all of these attacks, but by no means the only one, is the Anti-Defamation League, created in 1913. The full panoply of black reformists and revolutionary leaders were denounced by the ADL as extremists and Jew-baiting. The Caribbean-born psychiatrist Frantz Fanon was denounced because of his alleged hatred of Jews and the imperialist state of Israel. They also denounced Malcolm X, Stokely Carmichael, Eldridge Cleaver, H. Rapp Brown, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, the Black Panther Party, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale, and the singer Miriam Makeba. Right up to the present day, the ADL continues in denunciations of BLM. One key complaint was the black denunciations of Zionist manipulation of the anti-racist movement as far back as the 1960s were a mask for anti-Semitism. In fact, of course, Zionist penetration of the anti-racist movement has had the effect that some groups have a blind spot on Palestine. The denunciations have been accompanied by direct action. Since the 1930s, at least the Anti-Defamation League has spied on black critics of racism and have directly collaborated with the FBI and other organs of the state to attack them. In 1993, the San Francisco District Attorney investigated the ADL for collecting confidential information on nearly 10,000 activists and at least 700 organizations. The investigation showed that the ADL had directly surveilled and infiltrated social justice and human rights organizations. And its agents had received stolen police files from a surveillance program deemed illegal. The ADL even spied on anti-apartheid activists in the US and sold its intelligence to BOS, the intelligence agency of the South African apartheid regime, as well as providing information to Mossad. For the ADL, the black-led anti-racist movement is a bigger threat to Jewish interests than the far-right and white supremacists. When Zionists complain about black anti-Semitism, they're really complaining about uppity black people, especially those who are critical of Israel and Zionism.
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and a former professor at Bristol University, and he's a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. David's a co-founder and a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Jared Ball. Jared is a professor of communication and African studies at Morgan State University in Baltimore. He's also the author of The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power, a second edition of which is due to be published early next year. Jared also hosts the podcast I Mix What I Like, and he's a co-founder of blackpowermedia.org. His decades of journalism, media, writing and political work can be found at imixwhatilike.org. And we spoke to Jared earlier via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you, though. I mean, tell us about Marcus Garvey and what the Anti-Defamation League, often referred to by its abbreviations, ADL, has to say about him.
Well, Garvey was a hero of the Jamaican nation. And in the film, there was a photograph of a monument to him, which is currently exists in Jamaica. But he was attacked by organizations like the ADL, including the ADL, back as far back as the 1930s. He died in 1940. He was regarded as being an anti-Semite. And of course, they didn't pay any attention to his role in a kind of pan-Africanist consciousness, the raising of self-respect amongst black people in the US, and the arguments about what should happen in relation to racism. And of course, that is emblematic of the way in which the ADL and indeed other Zionist organizations in the US targeted anyone who stood up for black civil rights or who argued against racism.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, well, we asked Jared what he made of our report on the ADL's activities in the black community.
Well, the ADL's activities are pretty consistent with their class and ideological or political positioning. And as part of representing the interests of the state, so to speak, they align themselves perfectly well with all of the state's suppressive elements.
David, of course, Frantz Fanon, he wrote the seminal Wretched of the Earth and was active in the Algerian liberation movement, wasn't he? I mean, what was the ADL's gripe with him?
Well, it's one of the first instances, really, of the attempt to blur together anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. So they called him an anti-Semite, but what they were really condemning, and they say this explicitly, was his opposition to the imperialist state of Israel. It's a quote from one of their documents. So, you know, I mean, Fanon was, of course, involved with the FLN and the decolonization of Algeria. The Israelis, of course, as we know from previous shows, were involved on the other side and working with the settlers and with their death squads to target the liberation movement. So there's a very clear sense again here that this is about challenges to Israeli foreign policy interests, which of course is what the ADL was involved in from a very, very early age, you know, to actually pursue the foreign policy interests of the state of Israel, as opposed to pursuing what they were supposed to be pursuing, which is alleged anti-Semitism. Mm.
Well, we also asked Jared what the reaction to Malcolm X was from the white society in general and specifically from the Zionist lobby.
White America was and remains, I would argue, terrified of the actual Malcolm that existed, and which is why so much effort is ongoing to posthumously even rebrand him as somebody he wasn't, because his politics and his capabilities remain terrifying to those in power. So, the ADL and the Zionist efforts themselves part of a white supremacist, settler, colonialist, capitalist international apparatus targeted Malcolm just as the rest of that apparatus would, which was to, again, falsely define him, misinterpret him, rebrand and represent him in a way that stood against his actual politics and efforts, which of course involved all manner of what I and many others would consider greatness of socialism, pan-Africanism, anti-colonialism, among them.
David, there's a long list of black activists who've been spied on by the Anti-Defamation League. I mean, I wonder, are there any black groups that they didn't spy on?
Well, as you say, a very, very long list. I mean, practically everyone who you've ever heard of who has been a leader of a black anti-racist organization in the US has been spied upon.
Astonishing.
But the key question here is whether they thought that these organizations could be penetrated and mobilized towards their interests. Mm. So, for example, with Dr. King's organization, Martin Luther King's organization, they tried to work with that organization. They tried to penetrate that organization and make sure it wouldn't be critical of Israel. And they had some success with Dr. King. Indeed. In some respects on that. But they were still, his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Organization, was spied upon by the ADL, as was the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which is very close to Dr. King, back in the early 60s, moved away from it and especially split from it over the question of Palestine. So they wanted to penetrate those organizations, which they could do, to make sure they had a blind spot in Palestine. But they couldn't do that, they were denounced as anti-Semitic.
Jared then told us about the stance of Louis Farrakhan and the Nation of Islam to the ADL.
Well, here I would think there's a little bit of a difference, because the politics of Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam differ greatly, particularly on some of the isms I just mentioned. Whereas the Nation of Islam, even elements of the Garvey movement aspired to some sort of level of black capitalism, which is decidedly apart and more centrist than the politics of Malcolm and many others to his left. They were still seen as threats to the establishment simply on the basis of their condemnation of the white supremacist nature of the state, of the treatment of black people, of the suppression of Islam and variations of black nationalism, which are and remain important to black liberation. But there is a difference and a nuance here in terms of how the ADL and other elements of the state look to suppress various elements, on the other hand, of the black community and its liberation movement.
Well, thanks for that. Let's just pause there for a moment. This report about how the Anti-Defamation League has been spying on black activists in recent times.
From spying on Desmond Tutu for the South African apartheid regime to smearing Mark Lamont Hill and Ilhan Omar, the Anti-Defamation League sure does get around. In fact, it was found that the cagey organization had spied on at least 10,000 activists in 700 organizations across 7 U.S. cities. At the same time it was spying on Desmond Tutu and selling the information to the apartheid regime, Israeli political figure Shimon Peres was attempting to arm minority white rule in South Africa with nuclear weapons. In 1968, the FBI began officially collaborating with the ADL, with the director of the government agency informing all branches to directly liaise with their regional leaders of the lobby group. This was, of course, simultaneous to the FBI's war against the black community known as COINTELPRO. Was the ADL involved in this shabby conspiracy too? This level of cooperation between the FBI and the ADL did not stop an internal memo by the agency in 1969 from questioning if the ADL worked for Israel. The now declassified document reads, "It is felt incredible to assume the information is not furnished to an official of the government of Israel. It is believed it very possibly represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Despite that, today the ADL is the largest non-governmental trainer of law enforcement in the US and is closer to the FBI than ever." Which brings us to the question of a key asset in the black community, the Reverend Al Sharpton. He has admitted spying on others for the FBI in the 1980s, describing his role as cooperating with an investigation by using electronic recording equipment in a briefcase to secretly record conversations with targets of interest. He is perhaps the ADL's strongest advocate in the African-American community, regularly appearing alongside ADL leader Jonathan Greenblatt to support his statements. Less known about Al Sharpton is that for many years his show on MSNBC has been produced by Moshe Arenstein, a former intelligence officer in the Israeli military. The black community in the United States is being targeted.
David, that's a really huge number of individuals and groups being spied on, isn't it? I mean, and all this was done with the connivance of the FBI.
The connivance of the FBI going back way back into the century, into the 1940s. There was a involvement there from the 1940s. The ADL tried itself to, first of all, to infiltrate the FBI, and that was rebuffed back in the 40s. But then they started to work very closely with them. And all the way through this period, they've worked closely with them. In the 60s, the files now show, there was some kind of questioning about what that, and we saw in the previous film, the whole question about the relationship with Israel, and the FBI said, well, of course, these people are giving this stuff to Mossad, but this is a bit dodgy, and it probably is against the law, but nevertheless, they continue to collaborate with them. And it was only in the 1990s that the investigations first happened in San Francisco of some of the activities where these stats came out, the thousands of people, the hundreds of organizations which were spied upon. What's interesting about this is the way in which that relationship continues to this day. They advertise that they work together. And really what we should be seeing is a move away from the FBI and law enforcement working with the ADL, and more the ADL being monitored by the FBI, because they're clearly working on behalf of a hostile foreign government. And there seems to be no recognition of that in law enforcement circles in the US, but there is in civil society.
Mm. Well, Jared then explained how the ADL's influential position at both YouTube and PayPal in vetting content and access to these services actually affects those platforms.
Well, I don't think the ADL has, from my vantage point at least, I don't think the ADL has any more of an undue negative influence than the platforms already in their commercial organization have from the outset. What the ADL does is play its role within that broader apparatus of pro-imperialist, pro-Zionist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist workings, to limit discussion and narrow discussion to what is considered sanctionable or acceptable to those politics. So they fit right in, is sort of the point that I'm getting at. Without the ADL's involvement, there would still be plenty of white supremacist and pro-capitalist and imperialist narrowing of discussion, whether it's through the advertising arrangement, whether it's through outright surveillance and suppression of radical politics, or the like. So here the ADL exists really to play the role among a certain class and ideology of Jews initially and Zionists more broadly to limit the discussion, even among the Jewish community, to make sure that radicalism doesn't go too far or get too much of a platform even among Jews. So that is clearly their tactic historically, and have used the anti-Semitic trope and the fear of the rise of a new black anti-Semitism for decades now to target, in this case, all forms of the black left, to make sure that whether it's on Twitter or historically in newspapers or magazines or elsewhere, that those politics remain equally narrow.
David, the ADL published a hair-raising paper back in 1992 entitled The Anti-Semitism of Black Demagogues and Extremists. I mean, who did they single out in that report?
Well, they didn't single out in the sense of a small number of people. They had a huge list of black politicians and indeed black cultural figures. So amongst the black cultural figures was Ice Cube, the rapper from N.W.A., also, of course, the rap group Public Enemy were singled out in this. You can see it on the screen there. The notion of a black demagogue, extraordinary, really that they could have got away with that. And this is a file which is publicly available and has been disclosed through FBI. Freedom of Information documentation. So there's a real sense there which any of the key black cultural figures or black political figures were being targeted by the ADL in a way which is really quite, from this distance, clearly racist. But what's interesting about this document is that they say in there that they target extremists. And of course, if there are Jewish extremists, we will target them as well. But this whole document comes about as a result of the famous Crown Heights riot, which happened as a result of a Chabad rabbi jumping a red light and smashing into two young black kids, one of whom died, and that set off the riots.
Yeah.
And there's no sense in any of this that Chabad, which as we know from previous programs, mm-hmm. is itself an extremist organization. And there's been, never been an occasion when the ADL has ever denounced extremist Jewish organizations. And that's partly because it is itself an extremist organization.
Mm. Well, Jared also responded to the claims about the ADL being useful to the FBI as part of its clandestine counterintelligence program known as COINTELPRO, much of which was actually illegal. Jared described some of the background to this mysterious program and explained how the ADL could have been useful to it.
Illegal once upon a time, but post 9/11 in the United States, most of everything that was done under the counterintelligence program is now perfectly legal. Making the whole discussion of legality almost moot. But the reality is, again, as I've been just trying to say, the ADL is designed in its own origin in politics and focused as, again, a Zionist, imperialist, pro-capitalist, white supremacist, settler colonial organization. It fits right in with what the politics and the goals of the broader state itself. And certainly the FBI has no problem in promoting those politics and ideas, whether among Jews, Arabs, Black Americans, Christians, whomever else. And that's exactly what they've done and will continue to do. So if the ADL presents itself as being willing to be used, in effect, to take advantage of the actual suffering of Jews historically and in real time, to become part of a very conservative and anti-human apparatus, well, then they'll be put to that use. And to that extent, that's exactly what the ADL has and continues to do, and why they will more than likely continue to find a happy home in allegiance with the FBI and other, again, members of that apparatus, more broadly speaking.
David, tell us about Al Sharpton, who was mentioned in the film there. He's a favoured voice, isn't he, of the ADL?
Yes, but he hasn't always been. And in this document we were just talking about a minute ago, he was one of the key people who was targeted by the ADL as being a black demagogue, an anti-Semite, who'd led what they called a pogrom against the Jews in Crown Heights and the Crown Heights riots. And, of course, now he's not. Now, so what happened? Well, what happened was that his organisation was penetrated. And we saw in the film there the relationship with his producer, who's former Israeli intelligence. But really what we're seeing is part of a more general process whereby the Zionist organisations try to penetrate anti-racist organisations to bring them on side so they won't criticise Israel, they won't stand up for Palestinian rights. And if they'll do that, then anything is fine.
Mm. Well, finally, we asked Jared what he made of Sharpton's TV show actually being produced by a former agent of Israeli intelligence.
On some level, I think it matters for sure, and I think it's something that is not to be ignored or set aside. But I think it's on some level even unnecessary to make note of, given the politics of Sharpton and his show. And Sharpton has made clear for a long time that he has been part of the rebranding of black radicalism, excuse me, as something that is supportive of black capitalism, liberal to conservative politics, et cetera. In other words, the rebranding of the actual revolutionary politics of a real life Dr. King as something that would be acceptable to mainstream American news and media, which is, to me, all the evidence we would need of the kind of politics that he is there to represent and has been there to represent. The added fact or note that you mentioned about his producer is, again, interesting and I think adds important context, perhaps, but ultimately isn't that important given the observable, demonstrable, performative politics that Sharpton has been and continues to represent.
Well, I'm afraid we're out of time today. I hope you've found the program informative. Thanks to our guests, Professor Jared Ball, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. And thank you for joining us today. We'll be back next week with more investigations and analysis on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, This is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Large majorities in the U.S. foresee economic hardship and political division at home, coupled with a decline in global U.S. power. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned, please. The website of RT wrote in this regard, Americans are overwhelmingly pessimistic about their country's fortunes in 2023, with 80% predicting economic hardship and 90% expecting increased political conflict, a Gallup poll has found. Respondents also see both Russia and the U.S. weakening amid the conflict in Ukraine. Published recently, the survey found that 81% of Americans expect their taxes to increase rather than fall this year. 79% expect a year of economic difficulty, and 65% expect prices to keep increasing at a high rate. Some 72% expect crime rates to rise, while 90% say 2023 will bring more political conflict than political cooperation. These trends have already been established in 2022. The year saw inflation rise to a 40-year high, with the Biden administration adding trillions of dollars in new spending regardless. Biden closed out the year by signing a $1.7 trillion spending bill, which, although heavily criticized by Republicans, passed Congress with the support of a handful of top GOP lawmakers. While crime rates have not risen nationally, violent offenses rose dramatically in some U.S. cities in the aftermath of 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. The American foreign policy establishment spent the year heavily focused on Ukraine, with Washington sending progressively heavier shipments of arms to Kiev and allocating more than $100 billion in economic and military aid to the country since the start of Russia-Ukraine crisis last February. Only 14% of respondents predict a more peaceful year ahead, with 85% anticipating a more troubled year with much international discord. 64% said that 2023 will be a year in which American power will decline in the world, with an equal number predicting a decline in other countries. 73% of Americans in the poll said that they expect China will increase its power in the world instead of the U.S. With their party entering 2023 in control of the White House and one of the two houses of Congress, Democrats are more optimistic about the year ahead than Republicans. More than a third expect economic prosperity compared to 4% of Republicans, while 47% expect crime rates to subside compared to 6% of Republicans. The website of Gallup also noted, coming off several challenging years, Americans enter 2023 with a mostly gloomy outlook for the U.S., as majorities predict negative conditions in 12 of 13 economic, political, societal, and international arenas. Gallup noted, when offered opposing outcomes on each issue, about 8 in 10 U.S. adults think 2023 will be a year of economic difficulty with higher rather than lower taxes and a growing rather than shrinking budget deficit. More than 6 in 10 think prices will rise at a high rate and the stock market will fall in the year ahead, both of which happened in 2022. In addition, just over half of Americans predict that unemployment will increase in 2023, an economic problem the U.S. was spared in 2022. On the domestic front, 90% of Americans expect 2023 will be a year of political conflict in the U.S. 72% think the crime rate will rise, and 56% predict there will be many strikes by labor unions in the U.S. Regarding world affairs, 85% of U.S. adults predict the year ahead will be fraught with international discord rather than peaceful, and while 64% thinks the U.S. power in the world will decline, 73% think China's power will increase. Americans are greeting 2023 with great skepticism, a little expectation that the economic struggles that closed out 2022 will abate. Few U.S. adults also predict the partisan politics that plague the nation will improve, not an unreasonable expectation given that there will be divided government in 2023 after Republicans won control of the U.S. House of Representatives.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified Prajani. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and researcher in the Hausa Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Relationships are like muscle tissue. The more they are engaged, the stronger and more valuable they become. That's Ted Rubin's quote. And Professor Nakavi, the relationships we see get stronger and valuable as they get engaged. But what if our teenage gets engaged into a relationship which is not allowed? How do we take out our teenager from this social relationship?
So the first thing is that prevention is better than cure.
Yeah.
So that is important, that prevention is very important. Otherwise, the cure is very difficult.
Yeah.
Just as, you know, a person gets in...
When he gets into something, it's very difficult to take out.
Just like getting addicted to drugs.
Yeah.
Smoking. I mean, smokers have a hell of a time, a difficult time, if they want to, even if they want to stop smoking, it becomes...
The body is again prone to this weakness.
It becomes an uphill task.
And the doctors say that it's for the lifetime they have surrendered to this smoking. Now their body is always weak towards it, even if they have left or quit smoking.
Exactly. I mean, I remember even my father, may Allah have mercy upon him, the souls of all the deceased ones. He had left smoking very early, maybe early 40s, 50s, but he got a disease which the doctors were saying, you left the smoking, but smoking, cigarettes have not left you.
Wow.
So that is a problem which is caused by smoking and getting into difficult situations like relationships which are not legitimate. That is a very difficult situation, especially if it leads to childbirth. That is very problematic, and that happens. And if that goes to an unfortunate position where you have to, the girl has to go for abortion, so that is a very difficult situation. And we need to do something to prevent it. Otherwise, the cure is very difficult. I mean, how do you expect to resolve that? But it has to be resolved. And as I was saying before, we need mentoring and guidance. We need to either we become as parents mentors, or we employ the services of a person who can guide our children in these difficult times, especially with respect to relationships with the other sex. Prevention, as we said before, fasting, praying, sports, exercises, getting engaged in activities which do not make our feelings aroused. Especially even within the house, even if I have a sister who is of a certain age, she should be careful in front of me if I'm a teenager boy, or the other way around also.
In terms of modesty?
In terms of modesty. Even my mother should take care of her clothing.
What she's wearing.
It should not be inciting me. So these are difficult times.
So you're saying that although you have mahrams around you in the family, all of them got to be modest towards each other.
They need to be very careful how they express themselves, how they make. So these are real difficult times, yes. But again, if someone has fallen into that trap, till you don't know that has happened, how are you going to resolve it? So the first thing is you need to be cool-minded, cool-headed. Even if there is a problem there, you need to deal with it in a very cool manner.
Yeah.
If you become aggressive, there's no solution to it.
Aggression never leads to a very good decision. Well, we'll discuss more on the topic after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm Zainab with Professor Nakawi, and we are saying how teens can deal with their relations, especially their social relations. So, Professor Nakawi, when it comes to relationship with others, what are the things that we can teach our teens?
Yes, so we need to be able to teach them how to deal with their siblings. With tomorrow also, they need to get married, especially if they are so much aroused and they cannot abstain from this relationship. They need to get married. It is wajib to get them married if they are not able to control their feelings. If they are going to get involved in illicit and illegitimate relationships, they have to be stopped by giving them, making them marry.
I don't remember which Ayatollah it was, but it seems that he in his teens says to his father that I need to get married right now. And it's midnight, and his father says, all right, let's think up to tomorrow morning, or let's take a couple of days. We will get you married soon, inshallah. He says, no, I need wife right now, right here. Exactly. And then they get to the neighbor's house and tell him, like, the situation is like this. Can you give us your daughter so that we can get him married? So he gets married at the very moment. So the thing is that whenever a person feels like his arousings have gone to a level that he can't control, he can't do it right away without any, making so much expensive gatherings and all. You can't do it just happen.
In a simple way.
In a very simple way. You have to control that arousing. That's
exactly.
Very important.
Yeah, so you need to prevent it. If you can't, then the cure is the cure which has been provided by Islam is this. And then you have to manage it. And then if he's going to get married at that age, which is not, he's not even maybe a complete adult, then he needs to be able to manage that relationship.
Yes.
So he has to be able to be guided through that. And again, a relationship with, then he has children coming, or she has children coming. Home economics, home management is the important thing which especially girls should learn. I mean, you send them off to study science and technology and become doctors and engineers.
Business administrators.
And so on and so forth. And they want to become professionals themselves. But what about home management? What about home economics?
That's very important.
That's more important for a lady.
Because they say that the way to a heart of a man is through the food that you cook.
Exactly. So, I mean, I'm not against ladies becoming secular education.
You're saying home management comes first.
It's more important. It comes first. And that has to be taught. And it starts off at the home. If a girl sees her mother being a good manager at home, then she can learn to become a good manager.
So in the areas where there lacks counseling, in what subject we should take, because I personally have gone through this. I first was a science student, then electronics, and then again, general science, and then I jumped into linguistics. So there was so much this fuss because there were no counselors in our times. So, but now today there are so many counselors out there. So you are, as a counselor right now for adolescents, are saying, especially for the girl students, that if you have subjects in the society, like you have tech, you have science, you have business administration, and you have other stuff, and you have also home management and tarbiyah, on the other hand, the nurturing of children, because these are coming up as subjects. So go for these. You can prefer these over those if they are in the society, especially the societies that lack counselors.
Especially if you're going to go for a degree, a professional degree, and at the end of the day, you're going to get married.
Your degree is not going to tell you how to cook at home.
No, even if you get it, many women get degrees, can get married, and they always involved at the house. They don't need to work. Their degree is of no use.
Exactly.
But the degree which could have been of any use was home management.
Yes. We'll talk more on the topic after a short break. LSR, stay tuned with us.
Ya muqdiy al-khayrat. Ya muqdiy al-khayrat. Ya muqdiy al-khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Ya muqdiy al-khayrat.
A very warm welcome. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing, and we're talking about home management when it comes to girls. So, Professor Naqavi, you were saying girl teens should be taking up subjects very, very carefully, because if they have a number of professional degrees, but once they are getting married, they have the degrees of no use because they are involved only in home management and they are not working at all. So you're saying that subject taking is also very important.
The career that you want to take, especially taking care of, I mean, the jihad al-mar'ati husnat taba'ul. And the Holy Prophet has said that the jihad of a woman is managing and taking care of her husband. Now, it's not...
That's so easy and at the same time so difficult.
It's considered to be a... It's a very difficult thing. Jihad, it has the reward.
But it has a very good reward.
It has the reward of jihad.
She, like a man, has not to go out of her home into the war field. So she can actually earn the very highest place, highest spiritual place, or the highest reward by just actually staying home and taking care of her household and husband.
Again, that does not mean that our women folk should not go for...
professional courses.
For essential services, becoming one of the police women or going into the army, even at the time of...
flying a plane.
Everything's allowed, it's okay. But this is essential. This has to be taken care of. And if there
comes a time in your life when you have choice between the two, you're saying home management is important for a lady.
It's important, very important. And otherwise, the family cannot be... I mean, yes, the head of the family may be the husband, but it's the wife who is managing all the internal affairs.
She's actually upbringing the generations.
Imam Khomeini has said that women may not become prophets, but they are those who rear prophets, who upbring prophets. To give birth to prophets. So women have to play a very essential role. And if in this tender age of adolescence, they are not able to manage themselves properly, and they get off on the wrong foot, then unfortunately they will have difficulties in their family life in the future. So they have to be very careful at this stage that they do not make or take the wrong decision and carry out something which will be maybe of a very minimum time for a small period of time. They will be getting pleasure out of it, but at the end of the day there's a hell of a fire which is going to be facing after that, not only in the hereafter, in this world. Because the future of their family depends on that.
All right. So the consequences are going to be great. They are going to be lasting for a long time. So the care needs to be taken.
Especially if we understand that marriage is considered to be a sort of a chain, when the chain is put on a man and wife, it cannot be easily taken off.
Yeah. And so you got to be making up this chain very carefully. You got to be choosing things from your subjects to your husband very carefully.
Spouse selection is very important, and you need to find a person who is compatible.
Because as we have discussed so many times, that it's from the spouse selection when the tarbiyah actually starts. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent,
and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran.
You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.